Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Flory, Chief Judge Siegel, Judge Hooten, the Honorable James B. Flory presiding.
All right, good afternoon and welcome everyone to this Zoom oral argument session of the Minnesota Court of Appeals. The first case on for argument today is Eiselman versus Public Storage, court file number 820-0092. Just a couple of opening comments by me. This is a pilot session for public viewing of these arguments. So I would just remind everyone, including anyone viewing by the public, that it's contrary to the court rules to record any part of these proceedings. The court will be making a recording and we'll post that on our website at the normal spot. So I would ask that there be no independent recordings made of the proceedings. Secondly, regarding counsel or anyone that is participating in the proceedings, it seems to work best if we mute ourselves when we're not talking so that we don't pick up the rustling of paper and things like that. And then the timer should be viewable on the screen. I will also keep track of the time independently. As you probably are aware, each party here will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments, and counsel for appellant, you'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. So with that, we'll begin with the oral arguments. I would ask that as you begin your argument, you identify yourselves for the record and for our benefit. So counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. I'm Edward Rooney. I am the attorney for the appellants, Penelope Eiselman and Margaret Eiselman. We're appealing from four aspects of adverse judgments in the trial court. One was the trial court's refusal to let my clients amend their complaint to state with particularity a claim for consumer fraud. Another was a grant of summary judgment against both my clients on their claims of conversion and civil theft. Third was a grant of summary judgment in favor of Public Storage on both those claims. And the fourth was the trial court's refusal to permit my clients to amend their complaint to seek punitive damages respecting the conversion claim. I'll start off with respect to the amendment, and I think it's, or the refusal to allow the complaint to be amended to make a punitive consumer fraud claim. And I think it's important to point out that although requests for amendment are normally left to the discretion of the trial court did not exercise its discretion in denying this amendment. It said it ruled as a matter of law that the initial order in September of 2017, granting the motion to dismiss my client's initial pleaded consumer fraud claim was with prejudice. And the trial court relied on Rule 41.03 of the Minnesota Rules of Civil Procedure for doing that. And it's our position that the trial court erred in doing that. That rule is not meant to apply to dismissals of complaints for pleading deficiencies at the outset of the litigation. It's meant to apply later on in the litigation after discovery and after the issues have been joined. And there are numerous Minnesota appellate court cases pointing out that the purpose of that rule is to allow the court to manage its docket and more or less sanction misbehavior as the trial has proceeded. It is not.
I agree, Mr. Rooney, that there's court authority talking about managing dockets, but can you cite us to any cases that say it was inappropriate to apply Rule 41 under these circumstances?
I've never seen it applied in these circumstances or challenged to be applied, so I can't. But what I can point out is that
at least a couple of opinions out of unpublished opinions out of the Court of Appeals where the rule has been applied.
Well, I'm sorry if I'm unaware of those, but all I can think of is if you look at the application of the rule by the Supreme Court in its published decisions, even farther along in litigation, it reversed trial courts who used Rule 4103. And if you looked at the record, might have been thought to have a good reason to have used it at that point in the proceeding. But what the Supreme Court pointed out is that the goal of litigation is to have decisions on the merits. And
so can I intercede and just ask a quick question? So let's assume that the court went on and said, okay, Rule 41, I already ruled on the merits, but as a matter of fact, a whole year has passed. I mean, and use the same reasoning that they did in denying the trespass amendment. What would be your argument to us if the court had included that in its analysis?
Well, hypothetically, if they had, I'd first of all point out that it wasn't a whole year that had passed. It was less than 90 days that had passed since the necessity for the amendment became evident, because the court issued its order dismissing that complaint, or that count of the complaint, in September of 2017, and the plaintiffs moved in December for their amended complaint. But aside from that, excuse me, Your Honor.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Do you agree, though, Mr. Rooney, that we have to initially resolve whether the matter was dismissed with prejudice or not? Because if, in fact, it was dismissed with prejudice, then there would have been nothing for the court to exercise its discretion on your motion for amendment.
Well, I agree. If it's been dismissed with prejudice, there's no way you can proceed. And that's the error here, is that it was wrong to dismiss it with prejudice, both because the wrong rule was applied and because it's so contrary to the well-established policies of liberally granting amendment and doing what we can when it doesn't prejudice the other party to have disputes decided on their merits. And this is utterly thrown out the opportunity, in this case at least, to decide it on the merits, the consumer fraud claim. I would point out, as because Public Storage has raised in its brief, in a related case where Public Storage brought in Penelope Eiselman as a third-party defendant, she was permitted as a mandatory counterclaim to assert the same consumer fraud claim that she wants to assert in this case. She'd rather do it here. But the point of that is, I think the trial court in that action correctly saw that if you bar it, it's res judicata, where there has not been a full and fair opportunity to litigate the claim. And that's just blatantly obvious, or blatantly contrary to the established policies of limiting issue preclusion or claim preclusion only after there's been a previous case in which there was a full and fair opportunity to litigate the claim.
There was nothing in the order itself that indicated that it was with prejudice or without prejudice. Am
That's
I correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay. So that if there is a determination that it was with prejudice, it's got to be pursuant to either a rule or case law. Am I correct?
That's the way I saw it, and I think as Judge Walker Jasper looked at Rule 4103 as the basis for concluding that it was a dismissal on the merits. I don't think she said with prejudice. I think the rule says it's regarded as a dismissal on the merits.
Now, Judge Flory asked you a question, and I was going to ask a similar question and maybe the same question, but I want to ask it to you again because this comes up with some frequency that people bring fraud claims and they don't plead them with particularity. Are you able to cite any cases where that's been done and then the court turned around and said, okay, I'm going to dismiss this one, but then allows them to plead with particularity, that you can cite us to as an example where the court's allowed that?
I'm sorry, I can't cite you to that, but what I can say is I can cite you to the cases that say the consumer fraud statute is a remedial statute and is to be liberally construed and applied for the benefit of the public. And it seems to me contrary to that policy to cut off at the knees a consumer fraud case before it's had a chance to be developed through thorough and accurate pleading and discovery. It's contrary to both res judicata and the policies behind a remedial application of consumer fraud statutes.
Do you think an argument could be made that because it is the consumer fraud statute as opposed to a regular common law fraud claim, that the pleading requirements may be different?
I think it's unfair in any circumstance where a claim at the outset of the case is dismissed for not being pleaded specifically enough to not give the litigant an opportunity to plead it specifically. As I pointed out in the brief, Public Storage knew that this was coming. There's no prejudice. There would have been no prejudice to Public Storage to allow this part to be better pleaded. And as you can see, if you made a reference in our brief, if you go on the record to the third party counterclaim in the related case, it's pleaded with great particularity and presents, in my view, a compelling case. And it's just contrary to why consumer fraud cases or statutes were enacted, to apply them so strictly so that the litigants who are really, think of consumer fraud, they are without a lot of information at the outset of their claim. They just know something very bad happened. So it strikes me as contrary to that. But I would, if I may, like to go on to the I'm certainly happy to entertain questions, but I would like to go on to the summary judgment issues, because I think that's, well, it's the fundamental reason we're appealing. And I think the most important fact for the court to bear in mind respecting the summary judgment is that it is the undisputed, unchallenged final determination of the trial court that Public Storage conducted the lien foreclosure sale by which my clients lost their property unlawfully. That has could have been challenged on review. It is not. And if you look at in that the trial court in granting summary judgment against my clients did two things wrong. It failed to view the facts most favorably to my clients. It made decisions on contested questions of fact, which a trial court may not do in a summary judgment motion, and it misapplied the law of conversion. And the we have clear evidence, undisputed evidence, that the sale took place, undisputed evidence that property of my clients was in that storage unit and all was sold at auction, and undisputed conclusion of the trial court that the sale was unlawful. And if
Well, what acts were done here that you consider wrongful or tortious that involve acts that are just not part of the of rights that arise under the contract?
The right to foreclose a storage lien does not arise under the contract. It is a clearly and only a statutory right. The contract does not create it. The contract does not alter it. The contract recites that it exists as it is required to do by the statute. But if you're looking for what's outside of the contract, it's the failure to give notice as required to the last known address as the statute requires. It's failure to accept a payment. It's bringing a lien foreclosure proceeding before payments are 15 days in default, which is in violation of the statute. It's, I mean, those are the first one. It's basically the notice. It's the not following the timelines that the statute requires that are the violations of the statute. And as I pointed out in the brief, the law of conversion, it's up to the defense. It's up to the claimed converter to show legal justification. All the plaintiffs had to show was ownership of property that was deliberately taken in a way that the taker exercised such dominion over it that it deprived the true owners of their property, so the taker should be obliged to pay for it. But the contract is a pretty much red herring issue as far as the conversion and civil theft claims go, because you cannot contractually limit or exculpate yourself from liability for intentional torts such as conversion or civil theft. So the court clearly erred in granting summary judgment on those conversion claims against my clients. And I believe it just as clearly erred in failing to grant summary judgment as to liability only on the conversion and civil theft claims in favor of my clients. Because as I said, we have undisputed evidence, the sale was unlawful. My client's property was among what was sold unlawfully, and they've lost it on account of that. And Public Storage cannot show a legal justification for that. So that is all parties have to do to establish liability for conversion or civil theft. I'd like to turn to the punitive damages issue. The trial court's refusal to let us amend our complaint to seek punitive damages for conversion, because I think it's a common problem we see. Granted, the overall rule is that the trial court has discretion to consider and allow or not allow motions to amend pleadings. But we also have a specific statute in 549.191, which creates a mandatory duty on the trial court. Trial court shall allow such an amendment if a prima facie case showing deliberate disregard for the rights of the plaintiffs is made. And prima facie case is one which does not consider defenses. It just looks at the pleading party showing. And so we have this tension between the traditional notion of trial court discretion and a statutory obligation of a mandatory duty to grant the request for amendment if the prima facie showing is made. And I think they can be reconciled by simply pointing out that a trial court never has discretion to misapply the law. And in this case, it's a misapplication of the law, first of all, to consider defenses when you're only supposed to look at a prima facie showing. And that the trial court erroneously did that. So I think the same elements that show why we are entitled to summary judgment on conversion, we have deliberate wrongdoing. And if you look at the punitive damages, we have evidence that this was not accidental wrongdoing. This is the policy of Public Storage, confirmed by the regional manager in his deposition and by their counsel in her letter when she said she reviewed everything. It was their policy not to give the notice that the law requires. And it was their policy to proceed with foreclosure proceedings too soon. So you can't say it was accidental. It was deliberate conduct. It deliberately disregarded the rights of my clients at least. And for that reason, we believe the trial court erred in not allowing us to amend our complaint. And I think my time's just about up. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Rooney. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. Counsel for respondent, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, my name is Abraham Kaplan, and I represent Respondent Public Storage in this matter. Now, the two most important facts in this case are that based on the undisputed fact, Public Storage was not found to have committed any intentional wrongdoing in this matter. And number two, that Margaret Eiselman, based on the undisputed facts, was not allowed to store property in the unit. Now, I'll briefly address the Rule 41 question and the motion to amend by the plaintiffs in this case. Now, Rule 41, as pointed out by Your Honors, has specific rules on what motions are considered by default with prejudice and what motions are not. Now, a motion to dismiss is not one of the exclusions, and by default, it is considered with prejudice. Now, appellants are not appealing the correct issue. The question isn't whether or not the court rejected the motion to amend with discretion. It's whether or not the original motion to dismiss was allowed to be with prejudice. And appellants are not appealing whether or not the original motion to dismiss was allowed to be with prejudice. They're only appealing the issue whether or not whether Judge Walker had discretion to reject the amendment. So, but even as it relates to the question of discretion, I'd like to point your honors to three orders from Judge Walker under docket 22, under docket 26, and under docket 62. Docket 22 relates to the first motion to dismiss, dismissing the claim for that it was not pled with particularity. Docket 26 is the judge's order rejecting plaintiff's counsel's motion to reconsider. And docket 62 is a denial on the Second Amendment complaint. And read in conjunction, Judge Walker gives very specific reasons for not allowing the amendment. The court found that plaintiff's counsel was pursuing the case in a piecemeal fashion and did not properly bring a motion to amend when faced with a motion to dismiss. The Judge Walker pointed to sort of a blatant disregard of the rules of civil procedure on how to amend the complaint to include a party. And for these reasons, the Judge Walker properly exercised discretion in upholding a previous dismissal with prejudice and not allowing the fraud claim to be pled. But regardless of Judge Walker's stated reason for rejecting the Minnesota Consumer Fraud Act claim, the court in Canburn versus Hubling specifically states that an appellate court reviews the underlying legal basis for a trial court's decision. And we don't have to rely on that specific stated trial court's decision, but any legal reason that this court finds could also uphold the reason to reject the plaintiff's second amended complaint. Now, in this case, the second amended complaint, again, attempts to do plead a Minnesota Consumer Fraud Act claim. However, the first requirement for a Minnesota Consumer Fraud Act claim is that it must require a public benefit. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has stated that a one-on-one transaction between parties can never be the basis for a fraud act claim under the statute. If this
isn't that something, I mean, that wasn't a basis given by the judge, was it, for the rejection of the complaint?
Correct. Well, the judge said it was not stated with sufficient particularity, and not being stated for sufficient particularity could be that there's no public benefit. And there's no public advertisement that's being alleged. But regardless, this court reviews de novo the legal basis for the rejection. So I believe this court has the opportunity to look at the proposed complaint to see if there's any public benefit alleged.
And was that issue raised in district court?
For the public benefit?
Yes.
Yes. The motion to dis- the original motion to dismiss to raise the lack of public benefit. So on an alternate basis, even if this court find that the district court stated reason was insufficient or abused discretion, I believe the lack of public benefit makes the claim deficient again as a matter of law and must be rejected. Now, going back to the claims for conversion and civil theft, there's a rule that in the independent duty rule, that once parties to a contract and explain the duties that they have to each other and write those duties to each other down in the contract, another party cannot bring a side claim for tort against the defendant. Now, the two cases that I think highlight this the best are cited by appellant in his brief, the Whitaker v. Collins case, where a physician was treating a patient and negligently cared for the patient, and the patient sued the doctor. And the court found that action was based on contract, it wasn't based on tort. Now, according to appellant's line of argument, there's no reason why this case should be any different. That the doctor had a duty of care to the patient, and he breached that duty by acting negligently. So too, in this case, the appellant argues that there was a duty of care and they acted negligently. The difference is when parties to a contract enter into an agreement and the allegations relate to the contractual duties, that's when the court rejects any independent tort claim. Now, appellants make an additional argument, and it was repeated by counsel in his oral arguments, that a statutory duty cannot be one of contract. But this is false. Number one, I cite to the Francis v. Union case in my brief, where the court specifically says that statutory duties are incorporated into a contract when parties enter into a contract. And this makes logical sense. Every UCC provision, every employment law provision would essentially make every single contract also have duties under a statute. Therefore, tort claims would be able to be levied against every contract claim and every other claim that has some ancillary statutory duties. Furthermore, the courts are very specific that it takes an exceptional case to be outside the independent duty rule. This is an ordinary contract dispute, an ordinary statutory damages. What makes this case exceptional? Now, that relates to Penelope Eiselman's claims for conversion and civil theft. that under the independent duty rule, Judge Walker found must be rejected. Now, regarding Margaret Eiselman's claims, appellants cite to two main facts that, in their words, the court did not properly consider Penelope Eiselman's testimony in considering the matter. They cite to a phone call that Penelope Eiselman had with Public Storage, where the Public Storage employee purported to allow Margaret Eiselman to have the same rights as her under the contract. And also, they cite to Penelope Eiselman's testimony that when she visited the Public Storage facility once, the employee told her Margaret Eiselman can store the property in the unit. Now, Judge Walker did consider these facts. And based on the rental agreements clause requiring all modification of contracts to be written, and based on agency principles where low-level Public Storage employees would not be authorized by Public Storage to modify a contract, the court found that even if Penelope Eiselman's testimony was true, it still would make Margaret Eiselman an unlawful store in the unit. So once Margaret Eiselman unlawfully stored property in the unit, she lost all property rights to bring a claim against Public Storage. Once Margaret Eiselman put her property in the unit, it's governed by the rental agreement between Penelope Eiselman and Public Storage. And the clause 3B of the rental agreement specifically states that non-occupants cannot bring property rights against Public Storage. Just because Margaret Eiselman didn't read the contract, it doesn't make the contract not govern in this situation. Public Storage specifically put every clause in the contract that it could to limit its liability in this case. And the question becomes, if Margaret Eiselman would have put her property in the unit without the consent of Penelope Eiselman, would she still be able to maintain a private action against Public Storage? If in the middle of the night a party sneaks property into a unit, could they then sue for a breach of contract or a lien act violation when the property has gotten rid of? Absolutely not. They lose their property rights once they unlawfully breach the terms of the contract. Now, this appellate court, in a related sister action to this case, Miller versus Public Storage, where it was the identical facts to this case, but the question was, instead of Margaret Eiselman, it was Penelope Eiselman's son, William Miller. And it was coming up from a judge's dismissal of William Miller's claims for conversion and civil theft. And the only reason why this court allowed the claims to proceed was that there was an allegation in the complaint that there was authorization from Public Storage that allowed the property to be put into the unit. So on the motion to dismiss stage, this court ruled that there was a well-pleaded allegation that he was authorized. But take away that fact, and in Margaret Eiselman's case, substitute a case where the undisputed facts show she was not authorized and she did not provide a written notice of claim, then the conversion and civil theft under this court's prior reasoning would then be taken away.
Mr. Kaplan, can I just interrupt for a moment? What are we to do with the fact that Public Storage violated the agreement itself? I mean, it seems to me that Penelope Eiselman did a lot to try to get, I mean, we wouldn't be here at all if Public Storage had started forwarding the letters to her correct address. It seems like she kind of went above and beyond. And so you're arguing the contract as a bar in some areas, but when is there a breach by Public Storage, you know, such that some of these claims ought to be able to go forward?
So is your Honor's question on Penelope Eiselman's property or Margaret Eiselman's property?
Let's stick with Penelope.
So Penelope Eiselman's property, she was awarded in the lower court the ability to proceed to trial and collect $5,000 worth of damages. The trial court found the public storage was negligent in not recording the additional address, but importantly, it was not intentional, it was not malicious, it wasn't willful, it was negligent. And the court stated that under the terms of the contract, she could proceed to trial to gain a maximum of $5,000 worth of damages. So that was her remedy in this case. And instead of taking that remedy, Penelope Eiselman dismissed those claims with prejudice in order to proceed on her side claims on the appeal. So she was able to be awarded all damages authorized under this contract. And additionally, she was allowed to be awarded all damages for all the worth of property stored in the unit. The contract specifically states that Penelope Eiselman agrees she will only store up to $5,000 worth of property. And it states that she waives all liability against public storage past that $5,000. When parties enter into a contract, they must be held to its terms. And she can't allege now to have stored $100,000 worth of property and proceed on tort claims. I think it's important to note regarding the independent duty rule that when public storage is alleged to have breached a term of the contract or a term of the statute, that's when the independent duty rule says you must proceed on breach of contract. If somebody peered into the unit and stole the property without any basis under the contract, that would be a different question, but that's not the case we're looking at it over here. Now, finally, with the civil theft claim, again, I would just point to the argument stated in the brief that the civil theft statute requires a willfulness and a maliciousness not present in conversion. Appellant is arguing that conversion and civil theft are the same, but again, the TCI case, TCI bus case versus Five Star shows that it's clearly not the case.
I note that your time is up, Mr. Kaplan. And so counsel for appellant, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal if you wish. You're muted, Mr. Rooney.
I thought I'd unmuted myself. Can I be heard now?
Yes. We can hear you now.
Thank you, I'm sorry. I'll briefly go through some misstatements that the counsel made in his argument. First of all, he said it's undisputed that public storage did not engage in any intentional wrongdoing. Public storage did not foreclose that lien, did not conduct that sale accidentally. That sale was deliberately conducted. And that is all you need, an intentional act. There may have been mistakes that led to it. And in the appellant's reply brief, I've cited provisions and comments from the Restatement of Torts. If the act is intentional, that's all you need. You don't need maliciousness. It can be an intentional act that was the result of negligence, but it's the intentional taking of the property. Public storage did not accidentally take the property from that storage unit. It intentionally took it. So there was evidence of intentional, and it's been decided that that was wrong to do it. Secondly, counsel says Margaret Eiselman, it's undisputed that Margaret Eiselman was not allowed to store her things in the public storage unit. That is not undisputed. That is one of the crucial disputed fact questions, because the plaintiff, Penelope Eiselman, alleged in great detail that she went to rent a separate unit from Margaret Eiselman and was told by the person who had a manager label on her shirt, not some underling, described as a manager, took a look at the unit and said, don't rent a separate one, put it all in here. That is as far as can reasonably be interpreted as an oral modification of the contract. So Penelope
But the contract didn't allow for oral modifications, Mr. Rooney, and it didn't allow for agents of the company to modify the agreement either.
Right.
Penelope signed a contract that had both of those provisions. Why should we ignore that?
Because Minnesota law permits contracts to be orally modified, notwithstanding that the contract may contain a provision that bars oral modifications. And aside, I mean, it's if nothing else, that's why. It's because she was told she could, but even that gets into a sidetrack that's wrong. If Margaret Eiselman had her property in there contrary to public storage's permission, it's still could be the it still could be source of a conversion lawsuit. Storing property with a landlord improperly does not give the landlord license to steal it. It may give the landlord license to evict the tenant. I mean, look at a residential situation. Suppose I'm in a no pets building and a friend says, "Will you just take my pet for the weekend?" And I do. And the landlord discovers it. The landlord doesn't have a right to destroy the pet. And if the landlord does destroy the pet, the true owner has a right to sue for conversion. It's a sidetrack to think that the landlord has to have given permission for it to be there or even has to have notice. If you look at the law of conversion, that is not the case. Now, also to get to another element is the independent duty rule. And the independent duty rule has been acknowledged, but if you look at the Rare versus Wild case, is there an independent duty that's been violated? Well, the duty not to take property from a foreclosure exists under the statute.
Isn't it the case, Mr. Rooney, that but for the contract, no property would have ever been stored in this unit? I mean, it seems like there's a contract, and that's the reason why the property was there to begin with.
Okay, if you take that premise, look at page 8 of the reply brief. We've cited numerous conversion cases where the property came into the converter's hand on the strength of a contract.
It doesn't matter, because if the contract was the gravamen of the agreement here, then there can't be a conversion or a civil theft claim under the independent duty rule. How do we get around that?
You say that you look at the previous cases where the independent duty rule was not applied, and you say there is an independent duty. The case that counsel cites about the contract being the gravamen is a 19th century case with a telegraph. And if you look at a better case, it's the one where I get to cite Justice William Mitchell, the Mickleby versus somebody, about a guy who was riding on a train improperly, and they threw him off and he sued them for injuring him. And they tried to say, "Well, you were violating the contract." And Justice Mitchell said, "No. His claim isn't for a violation of the contract, it's for disregard of his personal rights." And that's the same thing as here. So the independent duty rule does not apply in this case because there's an overwhelming duty. The breach of the contract did not cause my clients to lose their property. It was the unlawful sale contrary to the duties imposed by the lien statute that caused my clients to lose their property. So I think the idea of notice, the idea of property being stored without public storage's permission or knowledge, and are all sidetracks that misapply Minnesota's law of conversion. Thank you very much.
Could I just ask a question?
Go ahead, Judge Hooten.
I'm just looking at the conclusion of the judge's order, and one thing he talks about, the judge talks about, is that plaintiffs, and I'll just read it to you, in fairness to you, Mr. Rooney, plaintiffs also attempted to amend their first amended complaint to add a cause of action based on facts known to them since 2015 and did not make any effort to request the amendment when defendant served and filed its dispositive motion in July of 2017. And I think the respondent mentioned this issue in his oral argument. Since this is an abuse of discretion standard that we have to apply, how would this be an abuse of discretion if the judge is basically critical of how this First Amendment complaint was presented to the court?
First of all, I don't think it's an abuse of discretion because Judge Walker Jasper did not exercise any discretion in refusing this amendment. She said it was with prejudice, boom. She didn't even consider the complaint. She said, "You don't even get to bring it." But secondly, we thought we had enough in the first complaint. Does that mean if any time you lose on a motion that says you're not insufficiently specific in your pleadings, you're barred from it because you knew additional facts that you should have put in? It strikes me just so contrary to the policy of let litigation be decided on its merits where it doesn't prejudice the opposing party.
Right. It appears that the court, in addition to what was in the body of the order, seems to expand the reasoning to include the failure to serve and file the amended complaint at the time of the dispositive motions were heard.
Not dispositive. I mean, I think she's saying when we face the motion to dismiss for insufficient particularity, we should write then have moved. But I thought we thought we were going to win on that we pleaded it with enough particularity. So I think she's forcing us into an untenable position.
All right. All right. Well, thank you.
All right. And thank you, counsel, for your arguments and your briefing. We'll take the matter under advisement at this time and issue a decision within 90 days. We stand adjourned on this matter.